and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan, South Sudan, and the rest of the region this Friday, November 1st, 2024. A human rights watchdog says Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces raped women and girls in Darfur.
The markets were looted. The hospitals were also massively looted.
And some butcher men elect their leaders in South Sudan's capital, Juba.
I'm seeing that if the election have done itself well, we are going to see many things good in the future, and even the price, and even the bringing of the cows from outside to Juba town.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Republican Party's vice presidential candidate, Senator J.D. Vance, rose from humble beginning. He grew up in the struggling industrial town in the Midwestern state of Ohio. He went on to attend an Ivy League school and could end up elected as one of the youngest vice presidents in history. VOA senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Presutti takes us back to his roots.
This isn't where he was born, but this is where J.D. Vance calls home, Jackson, Kentucky.
Now, when I proposed to my wife, I said, honey, I come with $120,000 worth of law school debt and a cemetery plot on a mountainside in eastern Kentucky.
Breathitt County, Kentucky Sheriff John Holland drives us on a dusty dirt road and parks on a slight hill. He opens a rusty gate to show us that plot.
Grandmother Bonnie Blanton Vance.
Vance's grandmother was known as Mama.
He always came down here with Mama, and she would bring him to the mountains to let him see what mountain life was, and he evidently he liked it.
He was born in Middletown, Ohio, and raised mainly by his strict Mama, who cursed a lot and kept 19 loaded handguns in this house. With his stepfather's last name, J.D. Hamill won his first election, ironically as vice president of his Middletown high school class. He served as a Marine and then graduated summa cum laude from The Ohio State University. Then on to Yale, where Vance clicked with fellow law student Usha Chilakode, his future wife. College buddy James Imers knew them both.
I think she was able to channel some of that to JD, really kind of help him decide what he wanted to do and help, you know, kind of shape his future path in general from law school.
Vance became known nationally through his 2016 bestseller-turned movie, Hillbilly Elegy, about working-class America. It stars Glenn Close as a blunt mama to a young J.D.
But you got to decide you want to be somebody or not.
With the support of former President Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, the boy from Ohio who loves Kentucky, was elected as a senator from Ohio. And a quick 2 years later,
J.D. Vance to be the next vice president of the United States.
Trump chose Vance as his running mate, but he got off to a rough start, having previously called Trump, quote, reprehensible, and having claimed to be, quote, a never Trump guy. Now, as the nominee, Vance's policies reflect Trump's. And when asked, did the former president lose the 2020 election?
No. I think there are serious problems in 2020. So did Donald Trump lose the election? Not by the words that I would use.
Vance is hawkish on China and East Asia, opposes military aid to Ukraine, and...
Ma'am.
Could you tell me how you handled it?
In answer to my question on the Israel-Hamas conflict...
Kamala Harris, on the one hand, says that she really cares about civilian casualties, and yet she refuses to give Israel the weapons that allow them to minimize civilian casualties.
Vance's hometown of Middletown is largely Trump country. Steve Dillman hired Vance for his first job at age 16.
I'm very proud of what he's accomplished, and to be a part of that, it makes me really feel good inside. This is a man that has come from McKinley Street, and now he could potentially be the vice president of the United States.
If elected, Vance at age 40 would become the third youngest vice president in history.
Let's get to work and make it happen.
Carolyn Presutti, VOA News.
Tim Walz was elected to two terms as governor of the Midwestern state of Minnesota before he became Kamala Harris' pick for vice president. On the campaign trail, he speaks about how his formative days in Nebraska and how they shaped the person, candidate and governor, he has become. VOA's Natasha Mosgavoya visited the state to learn more about how the people of Nebraska remember him and feel about him now.
Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Walz spent the first half of his life in this rural part of Nebraska, about a five-hour drive from the nearest major airport. Here, the most prominent landscape features are often the grain silos. Some people here see a part of themselves in the vice presidential candidate.
When I see him on TV, he does not remind me of a politician. He reminds me of what would be my favorite teacher in school, because he's really invested in his community and his students, and he really has a high moral compass and good moral values.
Walz was born in West Point, Nebraska, and spent his childhood in Valentine, population 2600. Not exactly known for its political heavy hitters.
We followed Tim's career, I guess, a little bit at a distance. This step, we probably didn't see this one coming.
When Walz was a teenager, his father's lung cancer diagnosis prompted the family to move 160 kilometers to the north, closer to the extended family.
I grew up in Butte, Nebraska, a town of 400 people. I had 24 kids in my high school class.
Walz's family members still live in the area. His uncle, retired farmer Jerome Raymond, says he plans to vote for his nephew, but adds that he is a bit worried the small-town kid he remembers is too kind to confront the big world's challenges.
He was just your average kid. I mean, he was a good guy. Loved sports. Tim isn't going to be tough enough for Putin. It concerns me.
Growing up in the rural Midwest, Walz became an avid fisherman and hunter, not shy about his love of guns. Walz's camouflage hat was embraced by the Dirt Road Democrats.
Camouflage hunting represents Nebraska, I guess, and we're just taking it back for this ticket.
Following in the footsteps of his father, a Korean War veteran, Walz joined the National Guard at age 17, serving for 24 years. But for some rural voters, Walz's military service and history of gun ownership does not mean he shares the same values.
Nah, he ain't close. He lying through his teeth. That's Second Amendment right. I ain't taking his gun away like they're trying to do us.
Walz also supports abortion rights, which puts him at odds with many in conservative Nebraska, where some churches have memorials for the unborn, and the landscape is dotted with anti-abortion signs.
The most important issue for me has always been pro-life. Whoever is pro-life is who I vote for. He won't get my vote.
Walz received his education degree from Chadron State College, in a town where former President Donald Trump seems to be popular. The college administration recently had to take down his campaign flag after someone hoisted it next to the U.S. flag on campus. Chadron resident Miles Bannon says Tim Walz's local roots do not necessarily translate to support.
There's a lot of families who don't talk about politics very much because there's a lot of disagreements, you know, and I think that there's a lot of people who are comforted by him, but that may not change the way they vote.
Some here say that Walz has given rural Nebraska its 15 minutes of fame. But in this conservative U.S. state, shared roots isn't a guarantee of votes. Natasha Mosgovaya, VOA News, in rural Nebraska.
From politics, we go to beef issues. Beef prices have risen in South Sudan's capital, Juba, forcing the Association of Butchers questioning the quality of beef sold in markets across the town. South Sudan has the largest number of cattle in the region, but insecurity in cattle-keeping states affects the supply of beef across the country. For VOA News, Dennis Logonyi reports from Juba.
Members of the Central Equatorial Butchers Association voted in Juba Friday to elect new leaders who will help create order in the beef industry. Angelo Waninyombe, who is eyeing the top seat in the association, has pledged to work with the government to address health concerns in the local meat industry.
Cattle are being slaughtered in unlawful manner. The government has not given authority so we can do their work. We are coming to work with the government so that we can be able to provide services to our people. This will also help us to approach organizations so that they can treat the cattle in a proper manner.
Paul Ajak Moga, another union candidate, says he wants to bring together the various groups of butchers in Juba Town and work with them to benefit their mutual interests.
Busha men do not have unity in Juba. They are going in different groups with six groups, and their slaughterhouses are not permanent. The slaughterhouse available are for individuals with different prices, charging the way they want. Someone may ask 30,000 or 40,000 South Sudanese pounds per month. I have come up so that I can organize the bushermen to build a clean slaughterhouse, and I will be their security.
Susan Santalino Arika, a resident of Juba Town, says she hopes the butchers' union election will slow price increases in the marketplace.
I have seen that in the last years, there is no chairman. Markets are just going randomly, and even prices are rising up and coming down without anyone who is supervising it. I'm seeing that if the election have done itself well, we are going to see many things good in the future, and even the price and even the bringing of the cows from outside to Juba Town will be in better place and will be in better way than before.
Mandela Nelson Loku owns a shop in the custom market for beef. He says he looks forward to seeing changes from leadership of the Butchers Association.
Since the election has come, we really thank God for that. After all us, we need just one leader who can unite us all and make the work easier for all of us, because there are difficulties we face when buying those cows, and there are people sell it differently. So we have to get the standard price so that all of us can work and sell together, so that all of us, we the butchers and the citizens, can benefit, and also the president, because we need a good image. All we need is just to make life simple and easier for all of us.
According to a 2018 survey conducted by World Vision, South Sudan had an estimated 12 million cattle. The country's livestock population includes an estimated 20 million sheep and 25 million goats. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, Amnesty International says Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces committed atrocities in Darfur. Find out how after the break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Amnesty International is urging the international community to protect and stop deliberate attacks on civilians in Sudan's Darfur. The rights watchdog says relatives of victims of attacks said the rapid support forces allegedly attacked villages in eastern Jazeera state, killing people in their homes, markets and streets. Amnesty International researcher Abdullahi Hassan tells VOA's Carol Van Damme about the attacks.
Abu Akla Kekel, who is a commander, former commander of the RSF, defected from the RSF to the south. The RSF has launched retaliatory attacks in towns and villages in the eastern part of Jazeera, targeting communities there, including ethnic communities that are, aligned with KKL or where KKL comes from. What the witnesses told us is that there were massive attacks by the RSF who came into towns and villages, particularly the towns and villages of Tambul, Rufa, Al-Hilaliya, Al-Sariha, Al-Uzayba, where they came attacking civilians in the streets, in the markets, in their homes, killing people indiscriminately, and also targeting men. The individuals we spoke with, including relatives of some of the victims, said men were killed in the streets. The markets were looted. The hospitals were also massively looted.
Can you explain why these RSF forces take it out on these civilians when this RSF commander defected? Why are they taking it out on these civilians?
Historically, the RSF has a history, and the allied militias have a history of carrying out what we call collective punishment. For example, last year, they carried out collective punishment of the Masalit community in West Darfur for allegedly siding with the Sudanese armed forces or for being from a different ethnic community, because the Masalit in West Darfur are non-Arab communities and the RSF are generally supported by the Arab communities. So that's one. Number two, KKL was a key figure of commander within the RSF ranks, and the villages and towns that were attacked recently are allegedly aligned with him. And Jazeera villages are supporting KKL and his defection and the Sudanese armed forces.
Is there any evidence to support that allegation that they're supporting KKL?
There is no evidence that they're supporting KKL. They are being attacked because apparently they are coming from the same clan as KKL. That is the only crime they have committed.
Has there been any sign that either side, the Sudanese Armed Forces or the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, have been sincere about coming to the table and trying to find a way to resolve their dispute and put into play a lasting ceasefire?
There have been a lot of efforts by the international community, including recently by the U.S. government, that is trying to resolve this conflict. But unfortunately, there were a number of agreements that have been reached between the SAF and the RSF. But the SAF in recent times have been reluctant to participate in these talks. Some of the analysts we speak with are saying the SAF are playing delaying tactics because they want to regain more territory from the RSF. But both parties during this time have been committing serious violations, including war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Besides the fact-finding mission, what is Amnesty asking for right now?
We are also asking for the ICC to also ensure they investigate all the other violations that are taking place in Darfur. We are also calling on the UN Security Council to expand the referral, the ICC referral, the Darfur ICC referral to the rest of Sudan. That is, in terms of accountability, that is what we are asking.
That's Amnesty International Sudan researcher Abdullahi Hassan. He spoke to VOA's Carol Van Dam. Still on Darfur, rights groups are sounding the alarm about a spike in sexual violence and forced marriage in Sudan's civil conflict. In this report from Port Sudan, Henry Wilkins meets a woman who escaped the country's war-torn capital, Khartoum, after a paramilitary commander tried to force her into marriage.
Noor al-Huda Afif al-Din fled Khartoum, Sudan, around June this year. When the fighting started in April 2023, she decided at first to weather it out in the capital city. But her life with her husband and baby soon began to fall apart.
We had no electricity. We were sitting in darkness when my sister switched on the flashlight on her cell phone. That's when they started shooting at us. Literally, the facade of our home broke into pieces.
But getting caught in the crossfire was not the only danger she encountered. She also became a victim of an attempted forced marriage. the son of a commander in the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, one of the warring parties that has occupied Khartoum for most of the war, began visiting her at her home and insisting they get married. Her husband went missing one day and she later learned was imprisoned by the RSF. He has since been released.
The commander said he had dared to suggest that since my husband was missing, he should be declared dead and implied he might be involved in his disappearance. I told him I'm married.
Despite her protests, she was taken away from her family and forced to live in the house of the RSF commander, who also tried to force her into marrying his son. She says she was subjected to emotional and physical abuse at the house. Rights groups say countless women have become victims of forced marriage and other forms of sexual violence in Sudan's war. Letitia Bader is the Horn of Africa director at Human Rights Watch.
So we documented cases of rape, of gang rape. A lot of the rape by the RSF was happening in the context of people's homes, in front of relatives.
Aldin says other women living in the commander's house felt sympathy for her and helped her escape one night through a gap in a wire fence. With her baby and mother, she made her way to the relative safety of Port Sudan, where she now lives in this tiny apartment. She says her own trauma has spurred her to help others who have suffered similar experiences.
We decided to go to camps for the displaced and check on people who had problems in Khartoum. So I found people who suffered from the death of their parents, brothers, also women who were raped.
Sudan's war has also seen the rape of children as young as eight, according to analysts and media reports. Henry Wilkins, VOA News, Port Sudan, Sudan.
South Sudan in Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan in Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
And it's that time we hear from you, and we start with this listener who records himself commenting on your selections.
I am Jacob Yulmichan from Lagos State, South Sudan. The citizens of the United States have a duty to fulfill during the elections, to either make history by electing the female president for the first time in history, or they go back for Donald Trump, whom they dropped during his second term. In my opinion, the U.S. citizens must choose wisely, someone that will not bring the world into one-day conflicts, someone that will make the world a peaceful place, someone that will unite other countries that are in disputes and conflicts. Thank you so much.
And Benea Richard from Yei writes, the strike of the university lecturers in South Sudan was totally right, because how can you stay without salaries for 18 months? Where are we heading to? Francis Loting from Torit, Eastern Equatorial State writes, hello, John Tanza. This increment of MTN tariffs has affected some of us from communicating with our loved ones. Before, the Zol Kabir bundles was 2,200 South Sudanese pounds. It is now 3,580 South Sudanese pounds, which is a lot. These 3,580 can buy green vegetables and you can eat for 2 days. Bidali from Yei writes, hello, VOA. Hello, John Tanza. The entire people of Yei town are not happy with the disappearance of Mr. Muki, the CEO of Rescue Medical Center in Juba. Where are the Juba City security cameras? We citizens are tired of such lifestyle. Papa Allison from Yambia writes, hello, VOA. We are much concerned about the U.S. elections scheduled for November 2024. We need a president who will stop the useless war which is going on in Sudan, Russia, Ukraine, Israel, and the Hamas fighters, which had killed many people and forced many to flee and seek refuge around the world. Women and children are crying and dying. These people really need help so that they can reunite again with their family members. James Wani Natana from Bidibidi Refugee Settlement Camp in Uganda writes, "Hello, VOA. I'm urging the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to take concrete steps against the opposition in Sudan for atrocities committed in Darfur. Otherwise, whatever they did amounted into war crimes and crimes against humanity." Jacob Machueng in Rumbek Lake State writes, "Good evening, South Sudan in Focus. My view on the United States election is that what has Donald Trump left that he wants to finish now? If he had influence over Americans, why didn't they elect him during the second term? On Kamala Harris, how ready is she to bring peace to the Middle East and Asia that have been butchering themselves? The choice is for the Americans to either choose the first female president in history or they go back to Donald Trump. Views expressed in this segment does not represent the views of the Voice of America or the management of South Sudan in Focus. Keep your brief comments coming and we shall sample some of them every Friday. Our WhatsApp number is +1 202 630 8011. We now leave you with Colonel Mido with the song Longonyo. Longonyo in colloquial Arabic means someone who goes to count his or her money in the restroom.
Bisalata solo kebir, ma fizolo besu maleta. Dunia de, kanita solo longonyoe. Ma fizolo biruduita, ma fizolo besu maleta. Bisalata solo kebir, ma fizolo besu maleta.
We've been listening to Colonel Mido Samuel and the song Longonyo. For more on our program, visit www.voafrica.com. I am your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our team, Kwame Ofori and Engineer Patrick Deya, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Saidu Masakine, Saidu Akwanakulu.